I think there's a lot of progress and awareness on what we can do and how we can support and increase visibility and understanding of the queer experience. But on the flip side, I think there's like still a very strong resistance to the queer community. Again, it depends on what that person is focusing in on.
Hey everyone, Nathan Long here, president of Saybrook University. Welcome back to another episode of Saybrook Insights. You know, over the past year and a half, we've all been touched, good and bad, by the flurry of political posturing resulting in everything from wokeism to critical race theory to trans rights. Despite all of this hyper-posturing and focus, one thing is for certain, there are real people. Scores of young kids to older adults from marginalized populations caught in the crossfire of these debates. And these very real people deserve not only to be heard, but to be listened to and supported, including access to great, even good, we'll take it, mental health. Our mental health infrastructure, while increasingly better, still has a long way to go, from the dearth of Black and brown psychotherapists to the increasing need for LGBTQIA plus therapists and mental health supporters. Much work is needed to support the health and well-being of all of our communities, and that's the essence of the humanistic way of being in the world. So enter in today Dr. Alfonso Ferguson, fabulous faculty member in the Department of Counseling. Though he's still early-ish in his career as both a counseling professional and academic, Alfonso seems to have circled the globe and back with his varied efforts and accomplishments. I'm particularly interested in learning more about his work in diversity and intersectionality, specifically as it applies to counseling, but also how institutions and organizations are managing, especially in this day and age, relative to mental health and beyond. We're also going to dig into the work he does with marginalized populations, specifically BIPOC and LGBTQIA plus individuals. What's the current state, and where does he see this heading into the future? We're going to cover a lot of territory in this interview, so this is one not to be missed. All right, let's get to it with Dr. Alfonso Ferguson. Dr. Alfonso Ferguson here in the flesh. I've been waiting for this interview for a long time. We finally were able to get you booked. You're a man about town. You're in demand, so this is terrific. So great to have you, and thank you for joining us today on Saybrook Insights. Before we get started, for all my guests, I ask each of our guests to talk a little bit about yourself, your personal history relating to your academic and professional life and your journey to Saybrook University. So the floor is yours, as they say.
I can do that. I can talk about myself.
Yay!
And so a little bit about me, and I don't know how widely known this is here at Saybrook, but I have an Afro-Caribbean background. So I was actually born in the island of Jamaica. I migrated to the U.S. when I was about 9 years old, along with my parents and my siblings. And so being here, being in the U.S., it's almost like this land of opportunity, right? And so a lot of my siblings are much older, so they came in or came across with me when they were, they had already graduated high school. So their access to resources, scholarships, and things like that were much more limited. So for me, I'm first year or first generation grad student or graduate, college graduate. And then I kind of went all the way. I kind of went all the way in a big way. It's I feel sorry for like my nieces and nephews because I really set the bar kind of high, but I have great expectations for them and I know they're capable of doing it. But I say all that to say, you know, as a immigrant, first gen grad, this idea of like graduate school or getting your PhD or even counseling was really far-fetched. My family, my parents would have been very happy if I graduated high school and got a job and did my thing, right? And so it's really this innate ability that I wanted to like not only forward myself but also forward my family and for generations to come, for them to see like this example of what's possible, because it wasn't always there for me or for us. That kind of brings me to like the counseling piece, right? So coming from my Afro-Caribbean background, we never talked about mental health or mental wellness. It really was always shaped in the form of survival. what do we need to do to pay the bills, to get by, to make sure the lights stay on and make sure that we're all eating. And so this idea of going into counseling, I was actually introduced to counseling my last semester in elective class that I took in my undergrad year. I took like an intro to counseling course, and I was like, oh, this sounds like fun. I guess it's like what I see on TV. Let me look into it. And there were so many things that opened my eyes that very last semester that has like informed how I show up in spaces now and how I work with the people that I work with. Because within the Afro-Caribbean community, it's so there's such a taboo around mental health and wellness, right? To some extent, in my research, it's kind of been described as like throughout history as like, you know, a westernized thing. You know, what do you have to worry about if you have food on the table and, you know, your bills are paid and everyone is healthy? What's wrong? And so being able to like be that pillar of conversation for my family around mental health and emotional wellness has been big. But being able to instrument that in my research and in my community has been even bigger. Now, I know I'm going on a bit of a tangent, but yeah, that's a little bit about me.
Yeah, well, and how did you find yourself coming to Saybrook after this amazing journey that you had? And I want to get into, I have a question about that intro class you took, but I want to hear how you got to Saybrook or how you found us.
Oh, definitely. So Saybrook, I was working at another institution, a traditional I say brick and mortar institution where I would go and I would teach classes and go home. And I was on campus two or three times a week, and I wasn't super happy. And I wasn't super happy there. They were great. I was overworked. I was burnt out. I was fresh out of my PhD program, so I was eager. It was the middle of the pandemic. And so my thought of like what was possible, I wasn't thinking about that. I was thinking about what do I need to do to survive? I love teaching. I want to teach. I just got this degree and I want to use it. And I also wasn't ready to move. I live in the New Jersey area and my husband and I are very rooted and settled here. And so, you know, I started applying for institutions in the area. So I taught at a school. Students were great. Support was lacking a little bit. And so as I was talking to friends and colleagues in the field, they were sharing about different institutions that were kind of hiring. And so I had a friend of a friend who worked here. And my friend said that her friend, Dr. Burks, loves it here. Like, she can't stop talking about it. She really enjoys it. And she was listing all these positive experiences she's had here. And I think she had only been here for 6 months. So I met up with her at a conference and I was like, so what's the deal with Saybrook? Like, tell me more. And so the more she talked about it, I was like, I need to apply today. And I literally did that. She was able to introduce me to Jennifer, which was a godsend. And I applied that night. I was that excited about what I had heard and what the possibilities and the opportunities were there. But what really attracted me to Saybrook was there was this atmosphere and this energy from those two individuals that I met with that I could be myself here. And that was a huge part of like the next like professional home I was looking for. How can I show up authentically, fully, completely as me and not feel bad about it or not feel ashamed about it and feel welcomed and empowered about it? Because I feel like I have something to bring to the table and it may not be the same as everyone else, but it sounds like it's valued here. And so that's how I got here, and I'm glad I'm here.
Wow. I love that. Was fast. I mean, it's like, quick talk with Dr. Burks, then Jennifer, application, hire.
It was so fast. And just to put it into context, I think I met Jennifer October 11th. And then I put my application in October 12th. And I was starting interviews early November. So it really happened fast, like within 2 or 3 weeks.
We don't mess around when we know we've got someone good.
I know that's right.
No, that is fantastic. And I was, you and I were talking just for a minute before we got started. Yeah, I mean no disrespect in this framing of it, but you're kind of a young graduate, right? I mean, you're just fresh out of grad school for the most part. And, you know, we'll get into some of your work here, but for those who listened to the introduction earlier, Dr. Ferguson has a laundry list of amazing accomplishments in his short time. I wish I had had that coming out of grad school as well. Talk a little bit about your grad school experience, like how you managed to do all that. I mean, you're a first-gen college graduate. Family expectations, not to say they were low, but just that happy. I mean, kind of like in my family, happy that I would just graduate from high school a little.
Sure.
Yeah. So maybe talk a little bit about that experience.
I think what's really significant and important in sharing about the family expectations, and I'm glad you brought that back up, because a lot of it was self-motivation. A lot of it was self-motivation. And that also really showed up in my graduate school experience as a doc student. So going into grad school or in my doc program, I had never done research a day in my life. I was fortunate to become earn a fellowship, and I was a research assistant for Dr. Amanda Baden, who has done extensive amount of research around the adoption and the triad adoption experience, specifically as it pertains to adoption microaggressions. And so she kind of taught me the ropes as it pertains to research and made me fall in love with research. You know, I'm on a research committee now for a social justice counseling organization. And the focus for our platform this year is like, how can we make research sexy? How can we make research inclusive? You know, and I get really excited about it. But in my doc program, apparently I have this reputation because beginning to end, I completed the program in about 4 years. And when we got to the dissertation phase, I was on it. I was on it. And I have this reputation. My chair and I were still great friends. And I have this reputation, apparently, and he calls it the Alfonso effect. And so, you know, a lot of students who have come after me are like, okay, I know Dr. Ferguson did it in this amount of time, and that's what I'm trying to do. And how can I do that? And what are the steps? And it was kind of a perfect storm. It worked for me because my husband and I, he worked, and I quit my job when I started the program, and I started my private practice simultaneously. So I started my PhD program and my private practice. And so I would see clients on Fridays, but I gave myself Monday through Thursday to do school-related things. And so once we got to the dissertation phase and keeping that same format, I was writing every day. I talk to students who are in the program now and folks who have recently graduated. And I said, what worked for me was I almost had like a 9-to-5 schedule, and I knew like my power hours, if you will, the moments where I was high energy, I was most focused, I was most productive. And that often happened between 8 a.m. and about 12 to 1 p.m. So Monday through Thursday for those 5 hours or 6 hours, that's what I'm doing. I'm writing, I'm working on my dissertation. I had this thing where, and I think I also credit it a little bit to my anxiety, right? There's a healthy amount of anxiety that I have that I'm like, okay, if this is on my plate, I need to do this, this, and this to get it off my plate so I don't have to think about it anymore. And that's what worked for me. So yeah, I have this reputation at Montclair of, at least this is how my past chair kind of named it or coined it, the Alfonso effect.
That warms my heart to hear you talk about that. I think so often in graduate studies, students get caught right in this, there's that effect, not the Alfonso effect, but let's talk about the most treacherous, horrible, how horrible the dissertation research experience is. And it's almost like that conversation or narrative is designed to dissuade people from achieving their dreams, as opposed to like, you can do this. And also it doesn't have to take 6 to 8 years, right, to do. And I think you're a testament to that fact. You had some opportunities to do it full time, but we have students who've completed a PhD in 3 to 4 years and, you know, mapped it out just like you did. And I really appreciate you bringing that up. That's terrific.
Yeah. I think it has everything to do with discipline and time management.
That's fantastic. And I bet everyone was super surprised when you walked across that stage in 4 years with that PhD. That's pretty fabulous. So, you've got this really rich background. I want to talk a bit about, and I'm sure we'll weave in and out of your clinical practice, your research, and then eventually get to your teaching pedagogy, your style in the classroom. Maybe before we do that, though, I'd like to, spend some time in an area that is also near and dear to my heart, as I'm personally drawn to the topic. I have several family members who are out and have been working with therapists who are exploring their own inner selves and how to show up in the world. And your area of work in this is really, in my view, just so important and timely. As you assess the landscape nationally right now relative to mental health for LGBTQIA populations, how would you kind of rate it and why, like at this moment in time?
It's really hard to put a number on it. And partly because I think there are pockets of inclusivity and acceptability, and depending on the city, sometimes even the state you're in. But I know there are huge chunks of middle America where it's still not safe, or in the south where it's still not completely safe. And I think if I were to like call to action anything, not necessarily rate, but focus in on, it's the as a nation, we still have a lot of work to do. Globally, we still have a ton of work to do. And I think that it's really interesting. I was having this conversation with a client recently. I also recognize that living in the New York City area or region is a unique place to be, right? Especially for queer folks. And so I was having a conversation or having a session with a client a couple of days ago, and he was talking about like going outside of that New York City bubble and going south to South Carolina, and the ways in which he has to survey like his safety as a queer out black man. It's like I'm looking, okay, I'm not seeing any other people of color. Okay, I'm not seeing any pride flags anywhere. So can I hold hands with my husband right now? And if I can't, then what does that mean? And how do I navigate these spaces and ensure that I get out safely? And so when you think of things like that, you think of a lot of folks who are in these metropolitan cities who go home for the holidays or spend time at home or just don't go home at all. And they spend years apart from their family because of that lack of safety. So as a whole, as a nation, we've made some progress. There's increased awareness, there's increased visibility in some states. There's some protection for the LGBTQIA community, but in some states, there are no protection as it pertains to the workplace and discrimination. So there's still very much so work to do. And then, I don't want to get go on a tangent, but then there's like policies in certain states that are like, the Don't Say Gay bill and things like that that are impacting the youth of tomorrow. So when we say that, we've come a long way with like Marriage Equality Act and things like that, we're as a society, we still have so much further to go, and there's people who are actively trying to undo some of that progress as we speak.
Yeah, no, that's a really important point. I mean, right, the individuals who put that bill forward, now a law, say it doesn't say don't say gay. No, just about everything in it does. So, and to your point, it's rolling back the trans young people in Texas, for example, are also severely impacted as well. Given the polarized national debate around this, right? I mean, what are, I know you don't have all the answers, but I know you've given a lot of thought to this. Like, whether it's gay or trans rights or effective advocacy, what can we do as a collective society, as individuals in our communities, to do a better job for advocacy? And then I want to dive into the mental health piece, but kind of broadly speaking, what are your thoughts on that?
And so I did an interview a while back, and one of the biggest things that came up for me in that interview is how can we lead with love, right? I think oftentimes as a society, there's a hyper focus on what happens behind closed doors for people. But if we like not focus on that and focus on how can we love on each other, how can we be a support for each other, how can we, there's a proverb that Proverbs, and I think this is in all community, but specifically I know in the black community, it's treat others how you would like to be treated. You know, if we led by that, I wonder how much different the society would look and feel for people. I wonder how safety would look and feel differently for marginalized groups if we were just treating others how we would like to be treated or how we expected to be treated.
Oh, what a great point. I mean, that golden rule, though, seems so hard for us to follow.
Totally.
It really
Totally.
does. But what a great point. If we could just get to that point in a broader fashion, that would be a beautiful thing indeed. And in terms of mental health for LGBTQIA plus populations in general across the country, where do you see the gaps and also the positives, right? Because I know we've made some progress in certain key areas. Where do you see that, and where has there been effective inroads made, and what should we be doing more of, especially in this mental health crisis we're experiencing?
I think when I think about the mental health needs of the LGBTQIA community, I think of like the intentionality to create visibility and awareness. So I've seen it on multiple platforms where there's overt conversations around the impacts of like childhood trauma and or like difficult coming out, like experiences with family members and community members. And I believe that that's great, and it's creating an awareness for us as a society and giving us like the tools or even like the insight that, depending on how I react or how I engage with my queer family members and friends, this may have a lasting impact on them. And do I want to be responsible for that lasting impact? To some extent, you can't take all the responsibility, I'm sure, but to some extent, how do I want to play a role in that person's trauma? So there's like an accountability aspect there, and or responsibility for us as a society to engage with, again, marginalized communities in a way that's forwarding and progressive and supportive. Going back to that golden rule, right? How do I want to treat others the way I want to be treated? On the flip side, I'll stay there actually. There's also, I've noticed, and I also recognize that I could be living in a bubble, but I noticed there's an increased interest and willingness to be culturally responsive and providing services to marginalized communities. I mean, I teach in the field experience course, so I've often, not often, but at times I've heard from students who are at like placement sites who are not super progressive. You know, they're not focusing in on, they're not doing what they can to work with the LGBTQ community and create safety there. So it depends on the region, depends on the state, depends on the city, and also depends on the leadership within that institution. So I think there's a lot of progress in like awareness on what we can do and how we can support and increase visibility and understanding of the queer experience. But on the flip side, I think there's like still a very strong resistance to the queer community. Again, it depends on what that person is focusing in on. If we're focusing on how we can help one another and each other versus how we are different and how we try to create these barriers because we want to be more superior than others. And so there's also that element that's like fundamentally rooted in this country. And like, I don't think this is exactly applicable, but I think of like the classism, right? Being able to differentiate what makes me different or even better than you because I uphold these values or these identities and you don't. And I think that's an ongoing conversation within the queer community and how it impacts their mental health and emotional well-being. At its root, it feels like lack of belongingness. We all desire to belong and be a part of a community and be in community. But when there's like this clear segregation and separation because of your identity, then that also adds to or can contribute to the mental health implications and concerns. And that's oftentimes where you see queer folks are creating their own families or creating their own communities that are not like blood relatives, because there's that safety and belongingness there.
Yeah, no, what a great, great point. And I think you mentioned that along the way with the mental health work that's being done out there, a lot of really committed therapists doing the work, including yourself. How would you describe your clinical practice that you've created? want to hold on how you've built this amazing practice, but like in terms of working with LGBTQIA populations, like how does that manifest in terms of individualized work that you do with them on the mental health side?
I'm all about it. And so just a little bit about my practice. So my organization is called Good Work and Company, and we're based in New York City, but we also have clinicians, mainly me, licensed in New Jersey as well as Florida. And we are rooted in providing culturally responsive counseling services to multiply marginalized individuals, specifically those of the BIPOC experience, as well as those who identify as queer and or LGBTQIA+. And so there's an intentionality around creating a space for that population, because their needs are unique, and sometimes their needs are like very gray and very confusing and very complex. And so there's an intentionality in not only being equipped to work with that population, but creating a space for that population. And oftentimes how that has shown up for me is it shows up in my research, shows up in my work, it shows up in my clients, but it also is very intentionally present in my marketing. I want those clients to know that when they go to my website or they go to my social media, that they see themselves there, that they see that, like, this is a space for you. And I don't know if oftentimes the queer community and or the BIPOC community can see that in, like, the marketing or, like, just a representation when they go into a community service area.
So it's such a vital point you raise in terms of that representation piece. It's true at almost any institution, right? I mean, I think one of the first questions I asked when I first started here at, when I first started, the question that was asked of me is, Saybrook doesn't look like it has any Black students anywhere. And yet we did, and yet none of our marketing materials reflected that alone. And so I can well imagine, especially in such a very tender space like mental health counseling, to know that you could walk in and be safe, at least to explore, is so vital.
Be safe and be seen.
Yeah, a really great point. You mentioned, that your work is also with the BIPOC population, and you've been doing some work in around mood disorder, psychosocial stressors. Can you talk a little bit? Because I think some of that dovetails into your research, if I'm not mistaken, as well.
Absolutely. And I think, so in my clinical training, post my master's degree, work in the field, I've worked in various spaces. So I've worked in an inpatient crisis unit, which is very interesting and exciting. I've worked in outpatient. I've done like in-home therapy where I've gone into families who are have open like ACS or Child Protective Services cases, and this is just one form of remediation and support. And so I've been in the home, outpatient, and in inpatient units. And so what I've really collected from those various experiences are, it is important to note that BIPOC community may show up or may experience depression and anxiety or other mood disorders in ways that aren't in alignment with the clinical diagnosis or showing up in the textbooks, right? And I think there's that cultural piece. And for example, oftentimes Black and Brown folks have this, have been conditioned, because I do think a part of it is learned, a part of it is survival, that they have to work through it. So you may have a client who is experiencing symptoms, but know that, you know, my family is dependent on me, so I can't like give in to that. I got to power through and do this while not addressing like the challenges they may have. You may have a client who's resistant to coming into counseling, and there's very overt symptoms they're experiencing, but they don't understand why they're there, because they don't believe that this is going to help them at all. Like, they don't believe talk therapy is going to do anything, but they're either being mandated or being forced or like strongly encouraged to do it. So I think these are just a couple examples as to how like the cultural piece may show up in the room in ways that it doesn't typically show up for non-BIPOC individuals, or it may not show up for non-BIPOC individuals. So there requires a level of cultural responsiveness and humility to take a seat take a step back and decenter yourself and say, hey, there's something happening here and it has nothing to do with me. But how do I hold space for this person to make sure that they get the support that they're looking for?
Really, really well put. Thank you for that. You know, and as you've built your practice out, I think I love what you said about, you know, everything you just said and the representation piece. You've clearly put a lot of time into kind of manifesting something that's really impressive. And I am also amazed. I wish I could say that I've started my own business. I never have, short of a failed lemonade stand when I was seven. So, and it failed. So, you know, you've developed this, what sounds like a thriving practice. And I think for a lot of our students, our grads out there, especially from counseling, those exploring that, what went into its overall development? You've alluded to some things. And then given some of the challenges with like insurance and all that, you know, there's all that stuff. What's been your overall experience and the challenges, the benefits, all that good stuff?
Started my practice. I started in 2016, like I mentioned, when I started my PhD, and it was very necessary. I remember when I was working at a community agency, and I applied for my doc program, and I got in. And so as we got closer to the start date, the semester starting, I started to have termination conversations with my clients. And there was about a handful of clients that said, you're going to continue to practice, right? Because I want to come find you. I want to go where you go. I was working in Harlem at the time, and the population I was serving was about 95% black individuals in Harlem. Funny enough, we're in the center of Harlem, the mecca of the black community in New York City, and I was the only black male clinician there. I was of two black clinicians there, and we had a clinician or a staff of maybe 20. And so it was really interesting to see that. And so I had a very thriving caseload, almost unhealthy. I had on the day I resigned, I had about 117 clients.
Oh.
I was seeing some weekly, some biweekly. You know, on a busy day, I was seeing upwards of like 14, 15 clients.
Oh my gosh!
Right.
That's a lot.
And so to serve the population, though, it was amazing. So once some of my clients started to say, well, you're going to continue to do this, right? Because I've never had anyone like you and we need you. And so that's when I started my private practice, because I saw that there was still a need. And a part of me starting was to get on or continue some of the insurance panels that I was on in that community agency, because the people I wanted to work with, the people I know needed me the most, were folks who probably couldn't afford to do out of pocket $200 or $150 a session, right? It was the insurance folks. So till this day, I still take a few insurances. I don't take all of them. I don't have the whole spiel, but I do take a couple insurances and a lot of out of pocket. And so one of the things that have been really important for me in my counseling practice is being able to show up as myself and authentic in the work that I'm doing, so I can model for my clients that this is a safe space and you too can do this, but also being able to be culturally responsive. And what I mean by that and how that shows up in my practice is not using so much of the counseling jargon, right? At its core, it's a human-to-human connection. And some people just need to know that they have the space where they get to show up authentically as they are. There won't be any judgment. Someone's going to listen to them, support them, and empower them. And I feel privileged that I get to be that person for a lot of people. And so at its very core, it's how can I be and hold a space for my people?
That is just awesome. Awesome. Wow. I wish we had like 3 hours to talk through all the details. Oh man, this is terrific. So I have to switch topics for a minute, but it's all interrelated because this has all been social justice focused in a way in terms of the work. You're engaged in the amazing therapy and practice that you're working with clients on. I was thrilled. I think for a lot of our audience, Saybrook's mission is humanistically focused. We've talked a lot. Most folks know what that is who listen. And it is also grounded in a social justice orientation as well. And that has been the undergirding factor for Saybrook for a long time. And what just really got me so excited to continue these conversations in an even more robust way with yourself was this social justice mindset that you put right into your classes that's woven throughout. And we've had all sorts of conversations at Saybrook about weaving into the curriculum more of a multicultural social justice focus. And here you are doing it, it sounds like, really well. Maybe talk a bit about how that shows up in the classroom for you, for your students, how that may translate into practice down the road. Just be curious. And thank you for doing that, by the way.
No, totally, totally. I think it's important and also necessary. So it shows up for me in a couple of ways. And the one way that I could think of right now is, for example, the utilization of case studies or vignettes, right? Making sure that there's a multicultural lens, you know, not being intentional on incorporating like not only racial identities within that, but there's also like the ethnic identities, right? The regional identities and how those impact how someone may experience trauma and or psychosocial stressors. Though the Saybrook is student population is really diverse, students from all over. You know, so there are a lot of students who may not have that experience with racial or cultural minorities. So I feel like it's partly my responsibility to create an experience or access to understanding the lived experiences of my marginalized community members. And so by intentionally talking about it, talking about my work with my clients, giving them the landscape as to like what my practice looks like and bringing in real life examples so that we can talk through, this is what can show up in the space, the counseling space. This is how I've worked on it or worked through it. How would you work through it? Let's talk through that together and figure out how we can learn from each other, because not all of us will have the opportunity to be able to engage with a client like that. And for those of our, we may not know, we don't always know who is going to come into our office next. And I want to make sure that you are prepared to work with anyone. And so there's an intentionality in like, whether it's the vignettes and case studies or real life examples or sharing my own stories, but it also even goes down to like the textbook you're choosing. How are we critically thinking about what is on the paper? How are we saying, hey, you know, this author said something really prolific, but this one thing they said about all Black people do this, I don't know if I agree with that. And let's talk about that, right? Because we're not monolithic. So, and being able to have that conversation, because the last thing I would want to do or want to have on my watch, I feel like I'm a gatekeeper, absolutely. But on my watch is that one of my former students is going out there and doing harm because they weren't properly prepared to work with certain populations.
Amen to that. It's both theoretical and practical. Boom, right there. That is fantastic. And, you know, I think, do you see that manifesting itself in the students as they go out? I think you're still early enough in your Saybrook tenure, but where have you seen that kind of show up for students? Are they kind of taking that with them?
Yeah. And so I think What I love about the courses I teach right now, I get to engage with students in the very beginning of the program, in the master's program, and at the very end. So I teach the intro courses, but I also teach field experience. And so I haven't had the privilege, if you will, because I'm still early in my tenure here, to see a student and be able to reckon like where they were in the beginning and where they are at the end. But it's also, I've been able to see that for my practicum and internship students, because as you know, the practicum and internship experience is about a year long. So I've been able to see students, you know, get in the field and work with folks and do case conceptualization and provide them with feedback, and they come back the next semester and they're using that feedback, or I'm seeing how other students are engaging with them and how they're all growing collectively based on like our supervision experience and the feedback we're getting here, but the feedback they're also getting in their clinical or their sites. And so I've been able to see that in a rich and real way way, in an immediate way, that helps me to recognize that, okay, you're getting it. I feel good about you graduating this semester because you get it, and I'm proud of you.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's wonderful. Well, I'm looking forward to hearing more of the outcomes that we hope to see, but really, really fabulous that you're doing that. Note to faculty around the country, this is the way it gets done. So, yeah. So we're down to our last few minutes, and this is more of a rapid response kind of thing. So don't feel like you have to give it like in-depth thought, you know, just kind of first of mind kind of things. So when you think about our counseling program, and it is really, for those of you who are listening, one of the finest, I am biased, but finest counseling programs in the country, truly outstanding faculty, great outcomes. And as we attract students who come in, maybe what's one or two things that you would advise a student who's considering applying to the counseling program?
So a couple of things that come to mind is time management, the importance of figuring out your life, because your life doesn't stop because you're in school, right? So figuring out, setting yourself up in a way where you get to be in school, but you also get to live, because that can also reduce burnout. The other thing I think about is this program is going to challenge you. It's going to, if you allow it, if you are open to it, it'll make you a better person and a great clinician.
And it's going to be a lot of work. No two ways about it. So wonderful. All right. Number two. So far, we've had rock star answers, and I am confident yours will be no less rock star in scope.
No pressure.
What does the term humanistic mean to you?
So humanistic means to me, and I think I hinted at this earlier, because it's an embodiment. It's like, how do we share and engage with people in a way where we're equal? It's really at its core a heart-to-heart connection. It's like being able to empower people to be their authentic selves while also modeling what it looks like to be your authentic self in all spaces or most spaces.
Okay, so that's an A+ with extra credit because you added some context to it. That was pretty fabulous. Yeah, you passed that gauntlet. So the third gauntlet, you've got it. You're almost there. So remember the for Saybrook, we like to kind of practicalize things. That's not a real word, but you know, to make things kind of applied to a person's individual life. And with everything that's going on out there in the world, and with the wisdom that you've gained in your own life, your therapeutic work, your research, what are three things that someone can do to impact or affect positively their mental, emotional, and or physical well-being?
So immediately what came to mind, and I talk to my students about this and my friends, everyone about this all the time, set boundaries. Set boundaries with the people in your life, the new people, old people, but also with yourself. And what I immediately think about when I think about setting boundaries with yourself is, when do you stop working? When do you turn on, turn off? You know, a lot of folks work from home, and what some of the boundaries I have is I don't work on weekends. And that's a boundary I set with my students. And, you know, I will get to your email 9 a.m. First thing Monday morning, I got you. But if it comes in after 5 on Fridays, I'm out. I'm out of office. So set boundaries. I also think of physical exercise or activities and the importance of that, not only for your physical health, but also for your mental health. That ability to have that release is really important. That the mindfulness of exercising is a huge thing for me. The third thing I think about is build community. Build community, and I guess it's twofold. Build community and be in community, because community is important. Like, we like to believe that we exist in a silo and we can do it all by ourselves, but people need people. And there's nothing wrong with needing people and needing community.
An inspiring 45 minutes. I wish it could have been longer. You are outstanding. We're lucky to have you here at Saybrook, Dr. Ferguson. Dr. Ferguson, could you tell the audience, where can they find you on the interwebs? Maybe make use of your practice or find the greatest, latest work you're doing.
Of course. So you can find me on most social media platforms. Specifically, you can find me on LinkedIn at Alfonso Ferguson, all the letters, PhD, LMHC, LPC, all the things. You can find me there, but you can also find me on Instagram at Alfonso Ferguson, LMHC, or you can find my private practice, Good Work. And the Instagram handle is at This Is Good Work. And our website for Good Work is thisisgoodwork.com. And Good Work is spelled GOODWERK.
Master marketer, awesome faculty member. Really, really lucky to have you here today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. This has been great.
Well, we did it again. We had a fabulous interview with Alfonso. Thank you, Dr. Ferguson. Really terrific learning so much from you. I hope you enjoyed Dr. Ferguson as much as I did. Remember his three major takeaways, and I just love these. Set boundaries with people in your life and with yourself. When do you stop working? Turn that on, and when do you turn it off? The second one was physical exercise and activities, that mental and physical health really emanates from getting out there, getting active to the extent that you're able and can do that. And then lastly, build community and be in community. If you want to see the video version of this podcast, please visit our Saybrook YouTube page. And if you'd like to support the podcast, go to Apple iTunes and leave that 5-star rating and review and subscribe so you can get episodes as they come out. If you're on Spotify, it's pretty much the same drill, only you're going to follow us, and please do. You can, of course, subscribe to us on most major podcast platforms, including Overcast, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Pandora, and many others. Remember to check our show notes for information on today's guests and for more about our counseling programs, our master's and our PhD, or on the university, go to www.saybrook.edu. Click on Areas of Study at the top of the page and locate the programs to learn more. Or simply Google Saybrook University Counseling Programs. All right, that's it for now, everyone. Thank you so, so much for being a loyal guest and listener of Saybrook Insights. We'll be back for more just next week. Take care.